He's out there. He's talking.
Messages from the house.
January 31st, 2011, from the House of Representatives. Message number 175, third reading, passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill 120, Public Meetings, ayes 58, noes 2. House Bill 121, Public Records, ayes 54, noes 6. And House Bill 122, No Duty to Retreat, ayes 57, noes 3. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
January the 31st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred Senate File 146, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Barnard, Cole, Jennings, Landon, Rothfuss, Senator Co-Chairman.
Consideration of bills on general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, do you have a motion for us?
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into Committee of the Whole.
You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. That motion is carried. Senator Meyer, would you like to return to the desk?
Committee of the Whole, come back to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 91. Will the reading clerk please read the file?
Senate File 91, Livestock Wildlife Livestock Disease Research Partnership Funding, an act relating to the Wildlife Livestock Disease Research Partnership, sponsored by Senator Hicks. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Fladren, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that do so with the do pass on Senate File 91, there is a standing committee amendment, and I'd ask for that to be read in at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Senate File 91, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 7.
Then for further explanation on this bill, I think we'll turn it over to the sponsor from our good mother county, Senator Hicks.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, this is to restore some funding for the Wyoming Wildlife and Livestock Disease Partnership. A year ago when they went through some budget cuts, this particular appropriation was reduced by 50%. They had been working on about $250,000 per biennium appropriation. It was cut to $125,000. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, would you move that amendment?
Yes, could I move that amendment, Mr. Chairman?
It is moved.
Again, this just restores the original appropriation back to $250,000. What the Wyoming Wildlife Livestock Disease Partnership is a coalition that was enacted of state agencies and the University of Wyoming back in 2001, and it was to address disease that are really common in wildlife and livestock diseases throughout the state and try to come up with some dollars to develop some research parameters to try to address some of these things. And I'd like to point out to the body, this program deals with two of the largest economic sectors in the state of Wyoming, which is tourism and agriculture, which are only second and third behind minerals. And what we're trying to do with this is be able to create an account that through the Wildlife and Livestock Disease Partnership is overseen by a board of directors, and that board includes the director of the Wyoming Department of Agriculture, the director of the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, the vice president for research from the University of Wyoming, the state veterinarian lab, and also the state vet. And they will oversee the expenditures of these dollars, and they request proposals within the state of Wyoming to address these diseases that are co-compatible between livestock and wildlife. There is a handout, should be on your in your basket on this, that shows where those expenditures have been in 2008, 2009, and the disease organisms that they were looking at, and also the recipient of those particular funds. And they range from the University of Wyoming to the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, and also the State Veterinarian Lab has received some of these funds in the past. I think it's important to point out that so far, if we go back and look at the fiscal year 2009 and 2010, these state funds have leveraged almost over $900,000 in federal funding from other sources, in addition to the monies that we've put in there. So not only is it important to have this fund to be able to address some of these issues, it's also an important fund to be able to leverage other research dollars to address these issues as far as diseases. There was one of the provisions in the standing committee amendment that I need to bring to the attention of the body, and that was on page one, lines 13, and it says, for non-brucellosis-related research. And where that come from is the committee had asked for additional information from both the Game and Fish, Department of Ag, the university, and the state veterinarian as to just what the state's liability was at this point in time with exposure to how much money we've committed to look at brucellosis. And I believe in the last year and a half to 2 years, that was about $1.3 million. So what they wanted these funds to do was kind of target other livestock wildlife diseases that were out there. A lot of the discussion revolved around the recent decision by the National Forest, Payette National Forest in Idaho, where 70 domestic sheep grazing allotments are being vacated by the Forest Service due to the potential contact between domestic and wild sheep, that they can transmit some diseases. So we're seeing, in that particular case, a real dismantling of that livestock industry associated with these co-compatible diseases. I would tell you that this livestock partnership was generated in Wyoming, has been working for 11 years. It was the genesis of this, that basically Wyoming has created a model to already try to address some of these issues between livestock and wildlife. This is a very fundamental piece to keep that effort going. If we can start to resolve some of these issues with good research, whether they be actual elimination or vaccination for these diseases, or just research on better management and spatial separation between livestock and diseases, it has big ramifications for both the livestock and the wildlife sectors in the state of Wyoming. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask to sit down and entertain any questions.
We are on the amendment. Any further discussion on the amendment? Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would speak against the amendment. I'm all in favor of the bill, but I do find the Standing Committee Amendment, the last line where it eliminates brucellosis research. Good research always seems to find some funding at the University of Wyoming, but by limiting ourselves to non-brucellosis in this funding source, I think we're missing the boat just a little bit, because if you look at the handout, how many of those involve brucellosis? Three. Brucellosis isn't just cows. It's elk, wildlife, and I think the premise of the bill is wonderful, but I would urge voting against that amendment, please.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, in view of those remarks, I would ask the amendment be divided, and that the first division be page 1, line 13, where it relates to the non-brucellosis research question, and then the second division be the balance of the amendment, which I think is all funding related.
Page 1, line 13.
sure that that deletion doesn't affect it. The chair will rule that is divisible, the first division being lines 10, 11, and 12, and the second division being lines 1 through 9. Is that correct, Senator Scott?
Yes, that's right.
On the first division.
On the first division, which is this addition of the non-brucellosis-related research, I would have a question, particularly for the committee. What are there some research areas that are being neglected because brucellosis is such an overwhelmingly important problem with us being having the natural reservoir for brucellosis where we can't seem to get rid of it entirely and it can spread? And does this just restrict just this appropriation, or does it restrict other monies that are already in place?
Senator Hicks.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. To answer my good senator to my left here's question, is the this amendment, as I understood it from the Standing Committee, was only to restrict this additional $125,000 for non-brucellosis-related research. We did get a breakout of what's already out there, and I can run through that. Most of the stuff that's brucellosis-related already that's come through the general fund is, here's $45,000 to the Wyoming Department of Agriculture, but this just funds the existing task force expenses to work on that. There was about $1.6 million that has gone to the Wyoming Game and Fish Vet Services to work on kind of research-related stuff to brucellosis. The Wyoming Livestock Board, through the state veterinarian, has a flow-through, and these were just to fund a position, and also laboratory equipment was about $281,000. There's $9,600 in the state vet's budget for out-of-state travel related to brucellosis. And then there was two other general fund appropriations, one through the University of Wyoming and one through the Wyoming State Veterinarian, that deal with the testing and reimbursement expenses. So those just give you some of the numbers that the committee looked at. But again, to address my good senator to my left's question is this would only tie this $125,000 to non-brucellosis-related expenditures, as I understood the committee's intent.
Are you ready for the question?
Chairman.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I would also ask your no vote on this part of the amendment. I think there's a committee that select this, and I don't think we should restrict them. And also, we do have the new vet lab that is working in these areas, and if they have projects ongoing that need a little money, I believe it worthwhile to leave this up to the committee. So I would say let's delete this part of the amendment.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. During the testimony in our committee meeting, it was provided that the funds for the brucellosis come through many different cans, you might say, or departments or agencies. Game and Fish, Livestock Board, we can go on and on. And so the question was asked if there were enough funds for the brucellosis testing and investigative services that come about when brucellosis appears in a certain area of the state. And they said that they thought there was plenty of funding there. So our concern was there were other diseases that the Good Livestock Board and Department of Ag were concerned about, blue tongue, pneumonia among bighorn sheep. And so this is when we provided this amendment as a standing committee to ensure that there's money available for these other diseases that they were just as concerned about. So that's why the amendment came about, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no further discussion, the question is, all those in favor of Senator Hicks's motion to adopt the standing committee amendment, the whole amendment number one, division number one, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That has been adopted. We're back on the second division. Any discussion on the second division? Question been called. All those in favor on the second division, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
That has been adopted, and we are now on a committee of the whole amendment with the... Yes, I think we have dealt with that already, and we can't deal that with twice in one day. So with the sponsor, we'll withdraw that, and we can... You can... Okay. Okay, all right. Okay, so now the question is on Senator Peterson's motion that when the committee of the whole rise and report that it do so if they do pass motion on Senate File 91. All those in favor say aye. Yeah. Oh, Senator Schiffer, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, back on the bill. The money that they're proposing to put back in here is part of the governor's 10% cut to the university. And the university, in all of its infinite wisdom and academic knowledge, went down through the list of a number of places where they satisfied that 10% cut. The block grant to the university, I think, is standing at around $405 million. Somebody from an appropriations will correct me, but that's a ballpark figure. In the course of that 10% cut, the university cut 88 positions. They did some other cuts in terms of travel, in terms of research funding, in terms of the colleges. My question is this the highest priority that the university needs put back into their block grant? Because that's what this does. This was the 10% that came out. This was part of it. And this may be the highest priority. I don't know. But I guess my question is, was this the number one? Because we're putting part of the 10% cut that this Senate voted on, we're putting it back in. And I just want to make sure we're putting the important dollars back in for our one and only state university. Is that where this suggestion came from?
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, actually these funds go into the Wyoming Department of Agriculture's budget, and when they took the reductions on this particular fund, it was reduced 50% from $250,000 to $125,000. This just restores them back. But this is within the Wyoming Department of Agriculture's budget, not an appropriation of the University of Wyoming.
Any other discussion? All those in the, so are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Peterson's motion that when the committee of the whole rises report that I do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 91, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 91 has passed committee of the whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 93. Will the reading clerk please read the file?
Senate File 93, Dietetics Licensure, an act relating to professions and occupations, sponsored by Senator Martin. It was referred to committee number 3, Revenue. The report's back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Emmerich, Perkins. No, Senator Kasin Hines, Senator Hines, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriation. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Flatiron, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a favorable recommendation for Senate File 93. There is an amendment, and I'll ask the reading clerk to read it in at this time.
Will the clerk please read in the amendment?
Senate File 93, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 9 after line 22.
Mr. Chairman, I move the amendment, and I'll yield to the sponsor, Senator Martin, to explain the bill and the amendment.
Senator Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'll explain the amendment when we get to that point in the bill, if that would be okay.
That's fine.
Mr. Chairman, I bring Senate File 93 Dietetics Licensure before you today from the Wyoming Dietetic Association. They are unified in seeking to obtain a licensure requirement for the dietetic profession, as Wyoming is only one of four states left that does not have either a certification or licensure requirement for dietitians. The proposed licensure bill has been crafted after a handful of recently passed Wyoming licensure bills, such as athletic trainers and respiratory therapists, so that the language itself is in tune with Wyoming's preferred parameters and language. Mr. Chairman, the association is well aware that the seeking of a successful passage of a licensure bill can be difficult and a complex path. Thus, the dietitians have set out on an extremely transparent, inclusive, and collaborative effort that began in May of 2010 in order to flesh out all issues that may arise well in advance of this general session and address the issues with other health providers in an efficient and fair manner. As part of this effort, representatives from the Dietetic Association have met with 19 state governmental agencies and associations. This bill is supported by the Wyoming Medical Society and the physical therapist as important to improving the medical team that helps get people well in Wyoming. So what is a dietitian? A registered dietitian is a food and nutrition expert who has met rigorous academic and professional requirements, such as earned a bachelor's degree with coursework approved by the American Dietetic Association's Commission on Accreditation for Dietetics Education. Coursework includes food and nutrition sciences, food service systems management, business economics, computer science, sociology, biochemistry, physiology, microbiology, and chemistry. Completed an accredited supervised practice program at a healthcare facility and community agency and food service corporation. Passed a national examination administered by the Commission on Dietetics Registration and completes continuing professional educational requirements to maintain registration. The majority of registered dietitians work in the treatment and prevention of disease, administering medical nutrition therapy as part of medical teams in hospitals, HMOs, private practice, community and public health settings, academia, corporate wellness programs, the food and nutrition industry, or assisted living and elder care facilities. The RD credential for registered dietitians is a highly protected title that can only be used by practitioners who are authorized by the Commission on Dietetic Registration of the American Dietetic Association. Some RDs may call themselves nutritionists, Mr. Chairman, but not all nutritionists are registered dietetics. The definition and requirements for the term nutritionist vary. Some states have licensure laws that define the scope of practice for someone using the designation nutritionist, but in other states, virtually anyone can claim to be a nutritionist regardless of education or training. The dietitians believe that the licensing of the registered dietitian will protect the public by establishing minimum educational and experience criteria for those individuals who hold themselves out to be experts in food and nutrition. The state has an obligation to protect the health and safety of the public, and licensing of registered dietitians is consistent with this obligation. Additionally, the national healthcare efforts have a great deal of focus on prevention efforts, such as utilizing a healthy diet to bend the health care cost curve and improve our state's health. The licensure bill will help put Wyoming on the same par with all the other 46 states that already have dietitian licensure and certification. so we don't miss out on opportunities such as grants, ongoing programmatic funding that are likely to require dietitian-level involvement in areas such as schools, elderly care facilities, or hospitals. A couple items to highlight for the body, Mr. Chairman. First, on scope of practice. Importantly, the proposed Lessinger bill does not intend to affect anyone that describes the nutritional value of products, nor would it affect other healthcare professionals. The day after this bill is passed, all licensed health providers can do what they were doing the day before under their license. They are not trying to fence out anyone or create new business markets. These folks are swamped helping people. If anything, they want to find ways to recruit more dietitians to Wyoming. However, the bill does provide recourse for victims of unqualified and unethical individuals who dispense improper nutritional advice and harm the public while holding themselves out as a dietitian. Second, on fiscal concerns. Importantly, the proposed bill will not create any new employees for the state. The bill includes an initial one-time appropriation of $20,000 to get the board operational and needed regulations written in the first year of operation. In subsequent years, consistent with Wyoming policy on self-funded licensing boards, the board will be self-sustaining based on the collection of licensees' fees for future years. The fee will be set through rulemaking by the board, but it is anticipated to be $200 per licensee per biennium. The Wyoming Dietetic Association has their members' support for this level of fee and for a licensure requirement to be placed on them in general. Last, with regard to operations of the board, there is no intent to require any Wyoming facility to alter anything they do today or hire someone they don't want to hire. The bill does not require any school, prison, or other entities to hire dietitians in any way, shape, or form. Additionally, the Wyoming Dietetic Association has gone to great lengths to make the board an efficient, effective, and inexpensive operation. They seek to have the board lean and with the most minimal cost to the licensee. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to start to walk through the bill, and when we reach the point of the amendment, I certainly will stop and we'll take that up. Starting on page 2, Wyoming Statute 3447101, the short title, provides the name of the legislation. Pages 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 are definitions. And this section defines the board, commission on dietetic registration, degree, dietetics, licensed dietitian, medical nutrition therapy, medically prescribed diet, nutrition assessment, and registered dietitians. Page 7, 8, and 9 is Wyoming Statute 3347103 are the exemptions, persons and practices not affected. And this section exempts from the Act in paragraph 1, all licensed health professionals. Paragraph 2, students. Paragraph 3, federal workers and Wyoming Department of Health program workers. Paragraph 4, any school district employees who plan meals. Paragraph 5 is for the exemption for the big box supplement providers, retailers. 6, college instructors. 7 would be the those organizations that provide weight loss consultation, and 8 non-resident dietitians who work in Wyoming 20 days or less a year. Mr. Chairman, the amendment is found on page 9 after line 22. And which reads, a person offering general non-medical nutritional information either as part of the sales of nutritional products or independently who does not represent that they are a licensed dietitian. And Mr. Chairman, the intent of the amendment is to further broaden the aid exemptions provided and to avoid the fencing out of those who offer general non-medical nutrition information and do not hold themselves out to be dietitians. If you, on page 3, paragraph 4, you would find the definition for the general non-medical nutrition information. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for a vote on the amendment.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, the question is on Senator Hines' motion that Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 93 do pass. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed, no. Okay, that amendment has passed, and we are back on the bill. Senator Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's go to page 10, 11, and the top of page 12. Wyoming Statute 3347104 creates the board and allows for the members, the appointment, terms, qualifications, removal, vacancies, meetings, elections, and what constitute a quorum. Page 12, 13, and 14, Wyoming Statute 3347105, Board Powers and Authority. And this section requires the board to examine, license, and renew the licenses of qualified applicants. Maintain a list of every person licensed to practice dietetics in Wyoming. Keep a record of all proceedings of the board that is available to the public, and maintain a list of persons whose licenses have been suspended, revoked, or denied. It also states that the board members will not be compensated but will receive mileage and per diem in the same manner as state employees when engaged in official duties. And last, it provides immunities from personal liability for board members for action taken in the performance of their duties similar to state employees. 3347106, pages 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, and the top of 19, is licensure, application, qualifications, issuance, and revocation of licenses, fees, temporary permits. This section requires successful licensure applicants to have an accredited college degree based in the nutrition and dietetics field of study, complete 900 hours of practical experience under the supervision of a licensed dietitian, and successfully complete national exam, be 21 years of age, and of good moral character. The section also allows a grandfather period of 1 year without examination to allow the current workforce in Wyoming to obtain a license in an efficient manner. The section also allows for a temporary license to be issued to those seeking licensure in Wyoming to allow them to immediately join the workforce while they apply. The section provides title protection for licensed dietitians in the letters LD. Mr. Chairman, pages 19, 20, 21, and 22, 3347107, license renewal revocation hearings. And this section sets forth the process for licenses to be renewed every 2 years, for a licensee to reactivate or be reinstated. It gives the board authority to revoke or suspend licenses or deny applications if a license holder or application is a bad moral character, acted illegally, or abuses substances. It sets up a process to investigate and hear complaints, obtain evidence, and requires compliance with the standard Wyoming Administrative Procedure Act requirements. Page 22 and top of 23, reciprocity allows the licensed dietitians from other states to be licensed in Wyoming without examination, as long as their license is from a state that has requirements at least as stringent as Wyoming. Page 23, 3347109, disclosure of information. In this section applies standard fines and penalties found in all other Wyoming licensure statutes. Page 23, the top of 24, penalties, injunctive relief, appropriations, and effective dates. and provides for standard penalties up to $1,000 fine and not more than 1 year suspension, I believe. I don't have that. And provides the $20,000 appropriation, as I spoke about earlier, for the first year of operation, and then is self-funded funding based on licensees' fees paid in 2 years and the out years. So, Mr. Chairman, that's a quick run through the bill. And
any discussion? Seeing Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have two questions on this bill, one of which will relate to the general need for the bill. But I have a specific question on page 19. Mr. Chairman, it's been my experience with licensure bills that the first thing you want to look at is the fencing provision and see what they're trying to do to fence other people out of things. And the fencing provision in this bill is on page 19, and it says, unless licensed to practice under this act, no person shall engage in the practice of dietetics or represent himself, etc. Now, there's quite a list of exemptions. And near as I can tell, that takes care of all the medical people. It takes care of the retailers who post nutritional information, give you nutritional information on the things that you're buying. They're all well exempted. But, you know, I can't find a definition of practice of dietetics, so I fall back on the definition of dietetics. On page 2, means the integration and application of principles devised from the science of food and nutrition, et cetera, to maintain optimal human health. And it seems to me there's an awful lot of laymen that do those things just routinely, maybe only for their own families. And I wonder about, couple that with the sweeping provision on page 19, now I think they would have the sense not to go after every housewife in the state. But I wonder if we wouldn't be better to, on second reading, come back and delete the phrase, no person shall engage in the practice of dietetics, and just say, less licensed to practice under this, no person shall represent himself to the public as being a dietitian or a licensed dietitian. We did that, I think we would prevent unintended consequences if we missed somebody on that general list of exemptions, and I can't see what harm we would be doing to the bill. So, Mr. Chairman, my question is, why don't we simply do that on second reading, and then we don't have to argue so much about fencing?
Senator Mark?
Mr. Chairman, I would have no problem with that. I would like to speak to the association and get with the good senator from Natrona County. But it sounds like a fair compromise to me.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, a question for the sponsor on page 19. Under section 33-47-107, it talks about license renewal, revocation, and hearings. And a question I have is, it requires a renewal of a license every 2 years. And if you could explain what the need, typically when we renew a license is because you have some type of continuing education requirement to stay up with that particular profession that you're in. And I don't see that anywhere in here, so I'm wondering, what's the need to relicense every 2 years? I mean, I don't relicense my driver's license every 2 years. Is there some rationale behind 2 years? Because without those continuing education credits or demonstration and proficiency within that field, it almost looks like we're just relicensing every 2 years just to generate revenue to continue to perpetuate the board. So I guess if you could answer that, I'd appreciate it.
Senator Martin.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't found it yet, but it does require continuing education requirements to maintain their license and to further their educational ability. But I'll find that reference in the bill.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the sponsor, and it goes more to the structure of this bill, because I'm not really quite certain what these people do. If you look at the structure of the bill, you have a whole series of definitions, and then you move right into exemptions, and then you move into the board and other things. But at no place in the bill do we ever say what they do. So the definitions are defining what. So I'm having a hard time, particularly for instance, when you talk about where they can do a nutrition diagnosis. That it says what it means, but are they allowed to make a separate diagnosis when they're treating independently? What does that mean? What does, if you go back and you look at page 4 and 5, you have medically prescribed diets, and those are in conjunction with or in consultation with a licensed physician. What I'm trying to get at is that we have a whole series of definitions, but what are they defining? We never anywhere in this bill say what they do.
Senator Martin.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to get with the good senator, and because I think that you're probably right, but I'd like to get with the association who drafted this and see if it does define it better.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, not finding a definition of practice of dietetics, my assumption was that they felt that the practice of didn't need further definition, and what needed definition was dietetics, and the definition for that is found on page 2. And I think it makes some sense. You could argue it ought to be more detailed. You could argue it ought to cover some of the other issues that have been raised, but that's what's there, and we could put in a definition, practice of dietetics means, but I think you've got the basics of it right there on page 2, and I'm not sure we need a further definition. Maybe we do. The question I have and continue to raise in this bill is, why do we really need it? We're going to put a burden on the people that are in this profession. They're going to have to pay for this thing. We're going to say, hopefully I think what we're going to say when we're done, is that you can't practice dietetics. You can't hold yourself out to be a licensed dietitian unless you really are. And the question I've got for the proponents is, why do we really need to do that? What harm are we taking in our current state where that is not the law?
Any further discussion? Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I signed on to this bill because I thought that the proponents did a really good job of addressing what the good chairman to my left is always concerned about, and that is that you don't want to be fencing anybody out. But the reality is, in healthcare, Mr. Chairman, nowadays, we do have new professions that are coming online all the time. We have new knowledge. We have new technology. And, you know, the fact is that's why we're living to be 100 years old now. And people like dietitians, I won't belabor what you've got on your handout here, but it explains that they go through a very rigorous academic curriculum. They are nationally tested. These are people who have earned a distinction that I think it's proper for the state of Wyoming to say it's okay for these people to hold themselves out to prescribe the kind of dietetics information that's going to save lives. You know, we're, the distinction here, this isn't, we're not talking about these people that hand you a six-pack of those cans of milkshakes and the promise that you're going to lose some weight. We're talking about people who can literally take somebody who's had a heart condition and make sure that that he or she is taken care of in a proper manner and has the proper diet moving forward. So that's why I signed on to this. I think it's needed. I think we're going to continue to need to address healthcare issues like this one that come up as we grow and mature in what we understand about health. We're going to have new professions that come on board, and I think it's important that the state oversee it and license it properly.
Senator Bebout?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions for the sponsors of this legislation. The first question is there a problem out there that people are practicing this and doing things they shouldn't be? If there is, I haven't heard that, and that doesn't mean it's not going on, so maybe you could share that with the Senate. The second question is there's an economy of scale and size when you look at these types of things and when you license. So how does this fit within the scheme of the people that we license in Wyoming relative to numbers? You know, you have the dentist, you have the doctors and so on, the engineers, on and on it goes. There's a number there that they try to do that to license. Where does this fit in? Is the number of 50 that I heard, is that in the low end, the high end, in the middle? Is there any relevance to that number?
Senator Martin.
Mr. Chairman, the number that was indicated at 120, but that does not include those individuals that come in from out of state and work here longer than 20 days, and that, which would also require a license. And we have some of those that work at the hospitals here in Cheyenne and some of the other areas.
Senator Burns.
And frankly, kind of somewhat dubious about the idea of needing the need for licensing here. My specific question is there, aren't the dietitians currently in Wyoming, aren't they already certified? And if they're certified by who? Is it the American Dietetic Association, or is there some group that does the certification for these? And with that certification, don't they have certain letters after their names? Just like, for instance, this licensing bill would allow somebody to be an LD. Aren't they already something from a national organization?
Senator Martin. Oh, excuse me. Senator Johnson, look to my left.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there's a young lady I watched grow up in Cheyenne, graduate from our high schools, went over to University of Wyoming and got a great degree in dietetics. And then for her internship, she went to Mayo Clinic, and she spent a full year at Mayo Clinic on that internship and came home. And there's a big brick building right over there. It's a hospital. And she's the chief dietitian over there. And when this bill came up, I went over to see her because I know her and I trust her, and she's brilliant and she has lots of common sense and lots of knowledge. And I said, "You in favor of this bill?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Why?" She said, "People are calling themselves dietitians in this state who aren't. Most of the rest of the country, the 46 states, say what a dietitian is. If you're not a dietitian, anybody can call themselves a nutritionist. That's fine. Let them call themselves a nutritionist. But a dietitian is an RD, a registered dietitian from a national test. Right now, anybody can come into this state, call themselves a dietitian, and they're really not because they haven't taken the national exam. So for the sake of those who are, let's say, in hospitals, I can remember when I've been in the hospital, my diet has been based on what I'm in there for. And the last time I was in there, there are certain members in here who called me and I asked them to bring me a salt shaker, and they said no. And that got well. So I have always been against fencing because I can understand why fencing's done and where it is, but having licensed dietitians who are nationally registered dietitians, I think is necessary in the areas where their job descriptions require that. If the job descriptions don't, like at hospitals or schools or wherever, then they can just have nutritionists come in. And I asked her, there are not a whole lot of you around here, and it's going to take a fair amount of money to support that board. Are you all willing to pay that amount of money in your license renewals? And she said, we talked about that, and for the protection of the people, yes.
Any other discussion? Senator Hicks.
One more question for the sponsors. When I looked at the last page and run through the numbers, they estimated that there'd be 117 initial applicants, and I believe the fee that they were looking at was $200. And then in 2013, they said there'd be an estimated of another 25 new applicants, and with the idea that they're going to relicense every other year, that comes up with a total budget of about $28,400. And I guess my question is that going to be sufficient to be able to maintain a licensing board, keep the records and everything specified in this particular act that says that they're going to do? That's a pretty small budget, under $30,000. So just a question.
Senator Martin.
Mr. Chairman, as the association looked at in developing this legislation, they also went back and looked at the previous licensure boards and the similar amount of money that they have, similar amount of numbers that they have, and they feel that figure is more than sufficient to deal with the numbers that they have.
Seeing no more further discussion, the question is on... Oh, Senator Barnard, let me get you here.
Speak here. As a member of a profession who has a professional board, I think this is really necessary. Your professional board will police some of your dietitians who move out of the realm that they've been assigned to. If there are dietitians who are derelict in their duty, it'll be the responsibility of this board to police these people, to help them and look after them. It's really necessary to have a board like this. If we don't credit these people who attend 4 years of college, and like my good senator from Albany County talked about, attend 4 years of college, go to a Mayo Clinic, get all these credentials, and we don't give them a license, it's just like not even licensing the teachers. Why do we license teachers? Why can't anybody go out and be a teacher? Because teachers meet certain standards, they have certain requalifications, and dietitians need the same type of thing. I would move really strongly to support this legislation. I pay $175 every 2 years. I have to get 40 hours of education every 2 years. And I think that's probably why they do that every 2 years, plus it generates the money they need to take that. I think the fees they've set here are very, very reasonable and attainable.
Question having been called, the question is on Senator Hines' motion. The committee of the whole rise report to do so with a do pass motion on Senate file.
We both understand.
Yes, we have. Okay, the question is on Senator Hines' motion that Senate File 93 do pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Division being called for. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed. Good. Now, get everybody awake. Okay. Senate File 93 has passed committee. The whole and next bill for our consideration is Senate File 117. Would the reading clerk please read the file?
Senate File 117, Wyoming Reclamation and Restoration Center. and Act Relating to the University of Wyoming, sponsored by Senator Bebout. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriation. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Flateren, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 117, and for explanation of the bill, I turn it over to Senator Bebout.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is a standing committee amendment. I would ask the reading clerk to read that in, please.
Clerk, please read in the amendment.
Senate File 117, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 2.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 117. Members of the Senate, the Wyoming Reclamation and Restoration Center, just a little bit of background about this and the purpose of the bill. In 2009, the legislature, in the appropriations process through the budget bill, set up an account through the College of Agriculture for $20 million to fund the Reclamation and Restoration Center. And that was the overall goal of that, was to have that $20 million in that fund. To get it started, they initially put $1.5 million of AML funds into that account. In order to secure the AML funds and to go through the process of getting approval through the federal people to allow those funds to be reduced, they had to do a different approach. So the university would spend the funds in one way and allocate the money back to the AML fund. They would get approval from the federal government. Then the university would set aside those funds. So what they in essence did is the $1.5 million went to the federal authorities. They gave approval to that. The university utilized those funds to pay for other things until they received the money. And now they have $1.5 million in general funds set up in an account at the University of Wyoming to do this. And Mr. Chairman, the issue that came up and why the purpose of the bill is over the years that we started this, there was some language in there that it was to be an inviolate trust fund, if you will, and there was no incentive for the industry partners to come and invest money in it because it was really anticipated that they would step up, but they couldn't get a return on their matching dollars because they could only use the interest from that particular $1.5 million. Later on in 2010, we changed that to allow them to go out and receive matching funds. They still did not have enough money to be able to really do that. And so what we bring this to you, and the legislature in the budget bill in 2010 funded this to the tune of over $1.1 million for that year in the budget cycle. And the purpose of this bill is to set up a mechanism to allow what we do is we ratify the action of the legislature in terms of the $1.5 million from the AML funds. We also allow that money to be utilized for matching funds so industry can step up and match it. And then we do away with the university having to receive general fund money to the university to take care of and run the Reclamation and Restoration Center. And that's about a $330,000 a year appropriation. That's the purpose of the bill, Mr. Chairman, to go through it. And I'll go through it and address the Standing Committee Amendment. And essentially, Mr. Chairman, the Standing Committee Amendment does two things. One, instead of calling it the Strategic Investment Challenge Account, it calls it the Reclamation and Restoration Challenge Account, and I think that's appropriate. We could get lost in looking for strategic investment, and that could be a lot of different things. So this more focused on what the intent of the bill was doing and what it was intended to be for. The second thing is on page 4, line 10, all grants shall be subject to the approval and oversight of an ad hoc committee of industry company representative appointed by the Dean of Agriculture. I think the purpose of that of the Appropriations Committee was to provide some oversight, have industry involved that's going to be matching these funds to be able to utilize it for the purpose for which it was intended. Mr. Chairman, if you go through the bill and starts on page 1, and we create these statutes 2116-601 through 2116-603, we talk about on page 1 the basis of it, the qualifying contribution of $100,000 as a minimum. On page 3, we talk about how the account matching program is set up. We shall, and if you look down on page 3, lines 19, the university shall match each qualifying contribution. We go on to page 4, at the top of the page, the university shall expend both the qualifying contributions and the matching funds solely for the Wyoming Reclamation and Restoration Center. And then, Mr. Chairman, an important part of the bill on page 4, line 10, the work of the center through June 30th, 2019. So, therefore, there will not be an appropriation requested by the university in the next budget cycle to fund this center. We will be able to do it through these funds. If you go on to page 5, on line 11, the university shall use the value of qualifying contributions based on fair market value. So if a member of industry comes to the university and has a contribution they wish to provide other than cash, they will be at the fair market value of that. Mr. Chairman, on the bottom of page 5, we want to know what they're doing, so we ask that a report be submitted to the governor, the JAC, and the Joint Education Committee. And, Mr. Chairman, on page 6, that's a ratifying language under Section 2 that gets into the $1.5 million from AML funds that we had to go back, get approval for it, submit it to the university through the Department of Environmental Quality, and this just ratifies the way that is set up in order to receive that funding. I had some trouble following that particular, the way that, the roadmap of that is, if you will, the way that happened. But essentially, there are certain requirements the AML has to have in order to grant these funds. The purpose that we wanted to do here didn't exactly fit that, so we set up another purpose, got the request in, they approved it, and then we turned around and put it where we wanted to. And, Mr. Chairman, that is the bill. At this particular time, I'd ask for a question on the standing committee amendment, unless there are any questions.
Any questions on the standing committee amendment? Seeing none, the question on Senator DeBeebout's motion that the standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 117 do pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That has passed. We're back on the bill, Senator DeBeebout.
I'd be glad to answer any of your questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion on the bill? Senator Nicholas.
Chairman, I left it to Senator DeBeebout to address the standing committee amendment committee amendment. I just got out of another argument, so I'm just warming up here again. But you don't have to worry. I'll warm up. Mr. Chairman, the last issue that the senator from Fremont County described was an issue with respect to these AML funding, and that is that you cannot use federal dollars to match federal grant dollars. So a lot of these, in these AML dollars that we set up, we did allocate dollars to the University of Wyoming for research and things like that. Well, when they went out to leverage those dollars to go after other federal grants, they found that, well, you can't use your AML federal dollars to match against other federal dollars. So what we actually engaged in was a swap transaction where these funds would be swapped with other areas in the university budget where there was no need to match against federal dollars, and their budget's large enough that the swaps work. So it's gotten kind of complicated. Well, I think, where part of what the standing committee amendments committee amendments were, and as we look forward, is this question, and really I sort of throw it back to the Minerals Committee because they really have an important role in this, but there is an issue as to whether or not these AML funding will go on. It was never our intention to use the AML funding simply to go over and augment research dollars to allow ordinary, customary research to go year on year in the university. Our effort was, with respect to this, the oil and gas dollars, the CO2 sequestration, and a number of other areas where we put a lot of money, was to engage in innovation and try to get university faculty, research scientists to step out of the traditional university research, get them into private industry, and really innovate to make sure that we stay the leading producer of minerals or energy, let's say, in the world. And when these AML funds fall off, we're going to be called upon to see whether or not we're prepared to support these programs with general fund dollars. And what we're really looking for is oversight committees, people looking at this from the industry, from the Minerals Committee, to give us a recommendation, advice when that happens, whether or not we're achieving what we are set out to achieve. And we're going to see this recurrent message on many of these research dollars that we put out. And that's the purpose for make sure the dean has an oversight committee. Since there was no established committee, we said let's take a look at the ad hoc committee. But I would, I guess part of the question here, and then this is to the Minerals Committee, do you have your eye on these? Are you thinking about where should we be in 4 or 5 years? And are we really seeing the innovation that we've been trying to fund?
Senator Bebout.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very good questions. And if you look at over the past 3 or 4 years, particularly since we were able to get that extra $83 million per year that the state of Wyoming has been owed by the federal government for AML funds we'd sent into the government but had never received, these funds have been used for a lot of different things. And the Minerals Committee has a lot of different areas that we are trying to keep track of. This is one that's a small one compared to the others. We've got to be very careful with the AML funds and the way that's set up because, of course, it's a tax on the coal. And the first $30 million that we receive every year has to be really, it's really designated by the requirements of the Act and the federal people that it should go to try to mitigate the impact of coal. Then there's an additional $80 million every year that I just mentioned that comes in, and we've funded that through the CO2's carbon sequestration program. We funded the General Electric program here in Cheyenne, a coal gasification. We've done a lot of different things with those funds, and those funds are running out. And as you well know, that there's a movement by the administration in Washington to take away all of our money, not only the $80 million a year that we get from the money they owed us over the past 20 years that they're trying to take, but also the $30 million or the amount of money we reinvest and send to Washington every year for the tax they collect on our coal. So that's an ongoing battle. And we, the legislature, I think, have to have a list of all those and be able to look at those and see how, in fact, we're going to fund some of these programs. The School of Energy Resources is another one that has received $20 million a biennium to fund that college over there to look at that. And that money will be gone. So how do we continue to fund that? A good program. This one, the nice thing about this particular bill, the Senate File 117, is we're setting it up using funds that's already transferred. And over a cycle of till the year 2019, we're going to be able to fund that with these funds plus the matching grants that we should be able to secure from industry. So to the Appropriations Committee Chairman, at least for this one, we know where it's going the next 8 or 9 years. It's something we have to monitor. But if you look at the overall thing of AML funds, we do not have a report that shows them all in one thing, and I think that's something we need to do to keep track of it. AML funds are not going to be there forever, and we need to be ready to be able to see if the programs we're funding, how we're going to continue to fund them, or if we don't need to continue to fund them, what do we do?
Any further discussion? Seeing none, the question is on Senator Nicholas' motion that Senate File 117 do pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 117 is passed. Committee of the Whole, the next bill for consideration is Senate File 119. Would the reading clerk please read the file?
Senate File 119, Real Estate Brokers and Salesmen Revisions 2. And Act Relating to Real Estate Brokers and Salesmen, sponsored by Senator Johnson. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Mineral Business and Economic Development, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, Jennings, and Ruffa, Senator Bebout, Chairman.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises and reports that do so with a favorable recommendation that Senate File 119 do pass. And, Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment that I'd like to have read in at this time.
Senate File 119, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 4.
Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 119. And for an explanation of the bill and the amendment, I'd like to yield to Senator Johnson. Senator Johnson.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The original Real Estate License Act was written in 1971. At that time, real estate licensees represented the seller only, and the words broker and agent were scattered throughout the act. Broker might have meant the person in charge of the office, or might have meant anyone holding a license. Agent was a term used when referring to someone with a license, as they were all seller's agents at the time. Today, a real estate licensee may work with the buyer as an agent, as well as the seller as an agent, or may work with the buyer or seller as a non-agency capacity called intermediary, or can work with a buyer or seller as a customer. Over the last 40 years, a handful of Band-Aid additions and changes have been made to the Act. These changes in themselves created conflicts with the original language in the Act of 1971. Changes in technology have necessitated this work as well. When additions were made to the Act, they may or may not have included definitions. When definitions were not included, they needed to be developed through the Commission's rules and process. This bill unifies and standardizes all the definitions. The real estate industry is always evolving. The statutes need to keep pace. As a regulatory body, the Real Estate Commission felt it was time to make a complete review of the License Act of 1971. They put together a committee of some of the best minds in the real estate industry with the objectives to first create a list of definitions at the beginning of the Act that would create consistency in the Act and do away with definitions scattered throughout this Act. Second, make sure that the generally accepted practice of real estate today and the Act were in conformance. Before you is the results of many months worked by that committee. And yet, when looking, you will see that the changes seem very simple and not overwhelming as they would be indicated with a 63-page bill. I will go through it as quickly as I can, page by page. Page 2, lines 14 through 23, simply cleans up old language and begins to use common terms, real estate activity and licensee that you will find throughout the bill. Page 3, the definitions begin. Lines 5 through 6 is a new definition and self-explanatory. 8 through 11 existed in rules and regulations and is a new definition in statute. 13 through 16 is another new definition in statute, but exists in rules and regulations. This definition is used in their requirement of mandatory errors and omission insurance. 18 through 21 are existing language. In the amendment, line 10 changes real property to real estate. Boy, you're going to hear that a lot. Page 4, lines 119 are existing definitions that are cleaned up. 21 through 23 are new definition, and the term is used throughout the Act. Amendment, line 10 and 11 changes real property to real estate. Page 5, lines 1 through 4 are new definition that came from the rules and regulations. They use the term currently in statute, but never defined it. 6 through 23 are existing definitions that may incorporate new technology for clarification and unification of terms used. 6, lines 1 through 19 are new definitions that are terms used in statute only, and only defined in the rules and regulations. 21-22 is a new definition also used in statute but never defined. 7, lines 1 through 4 is a new definition, again dealing with their errors and omission insurance and defined only in rules and regulations. 6 through 9 are a new definition. The board's statutory allows brokers to deposit earnest money with a title company in lieu of their trust account. Some of the new language suggested in this bill uses this term. 11 through 13 is a new definition. We passed legislation a few years back, allowing for a grace period, but never defined it. 15 through 17 is existing, just moved. 19 through 22 are a new definition and used in some of the cleanup language of the bill. In the amendment, lines 6 through 7 after holder insert means a title company, closing agent, or attorney licensed in this state, and we delete means a third party other than a responsible broker or estate company. That way Uncle George can't set up his own little fund and do it. And it's people who have authority to do it. And the word in trust is important here, as that means held in trust or a trust account in that amendment. Page 8, lines 1 through 8 are existing, just moved. 10 through 13 is a new definition and used in statute, but it was never defined. 15 through 23 both existed before and just moved. The amendment, line 13, changes real property to real estate. Page 9, lines 1 through 2 are existing. 4 through 7 are new and used in this bill regarding the licensing of non-resident persons. Line 9 through 15 is used in statute and only defined by rules and regulations. The language in lines 12 through 15 clarifies what is not material to a transaction. Line 17 through 19 currently exists, just moved. 21-22 is in statute, but previously defined only by rule. Page 10, lines 1 through 2 existed only in rules and regulations. 4 and 5 are existing, just moved. 7 through 12 again comes from the rules and are terms used in statute. 14 through 16 are existing. 18 through 22 again pertains to their mandatory errors and omissions insurance and used in statute, but only defined in rule. Amendment, line 9 changes real property to real estate. Lines 11, lines 1 through 4, language used regarding E&O insurance and only defined in rules. 6 through 9 are existing, just moved. Lines 11 through 22 and 18, and 11, 22 and through 18 on page 12 are definitions brought over from the rules regarding E&O insurance. Amendment, here, line 9 changes real property to real estate. Page 12, lines 20 through 24 existing, just moved. Page 13, all definitions exist in statute, just moved, and they're alphabetically, too. Page 14, existing language, just moved. Page 15, lines 1 through 5 are a new definition and used in statute and this bill. Lines 7 through 23 are existing in statute. Page 16, lines 1 through 5 again are needed. A needed definition for E&O insurance section of the statute. 7 through 18 are existing definitions. 20 through 21 are terms used in statute and come from the rules and regulations. In the amendment lines, 12, 14, and 21 change real property to real estate. Let me take a deep breath. Line 17, page 17, lines 1 through 3 are new and needed for E&O insurance. 5 through 9 are existing. 11 through 19 are new definitions and used in this bill. 21 through 24 and through lines 4 of page 18 are existing. Page 18, 6 through 10 are existing. Lines 12 through 18 come from their rules and is a term used in statute. Amendment, line 1 changes real property to real estate. 19, this page adds language to their existing exemptions to licensure, but clarifies that if a person is licensed, they are not exempt. Page 20, lines 6 through 13, incorporate new definitions to help this section read easier. Simply clean up language. Amendment, line 1 after change, line 1 changes real property to real estate. 21, through the rest of the bill, they have inserted licensee in place of broker, associate broker, and salesman for consistency and clarity. Lines 4 and 5 are for clarification. Other changes are housekeeping. 22, the term commission replaces board as they are a commission and not a board. Line 17 is clarifying language. Page 23 rearranges paragraphs to read better. Again, commission replaces board. 24, confirming language. Line 21 through 22, this should have been deleted in previous legislation as it is repetitive of lines 11 and 12 above. Page 25, this is a substantive change. Lines 4 through 9 change the requirement for a responsible broker's license. Old language would allow anyone with a degree in real estate to be eligible for a responsible broker's license. This change requires that the individual have a minimum of 2 years' experience in the business prior to being able to apply for a responsible broker's license. The rest of the page is cleanup language incorporating new definitions. Page 26, cleanup language, it simply reads better. Page 27, 28, and through lines 8 on 29, create consistency in the statute with requirements for a salesman license being substantially the same as that for an associate broker or responsible broker's license, except for the amount of education and years of experience. Much of the language was there, just rearranged. Page 28, continuation. Page 29 through line 8, continuation. 10 through 20, cleanup language. The requirements for an associate broker license are spelled out. This is conforming in language and relates to the changes made on page 25. A new section has been added to separate an associate broker's requirements from those of a responsible broker and deals with a person using a degree in real estate to skip the salesman license and go right to an associate broker's license. Page 30, lines 1 through 14, continuance of associate broker's license, 15 through 23, and on to page 31, lines 1 through 6, are existing language moved for clarity. Page 31, cleanup language. Page 32, cleanup language. Page 33, cleanup language. 34, cleanup language. 35, lines through 4 through 24, incorporation of new definitions for clarity, and spells out the requirements for a non-resident to obtain a Wyoming real estate license. The use of reciprocal licenses is being eliminated by most jurisdictions and being replaced with the issuing of a non-resident license. A license issued under reciprocity did not have to have proof of a passing score on the Wyoming state portion of the real estate exam. A non-resident applicant must take the Wyoming state portion of the state exam. And our licensees have to do the same thing in the other states. Page 36, continuing requirements for a non-resident license. 37, continuation for requirements of non-resident license, mostly cleanup language. 38 incorporates new definitions for clarity and cleanup language. In the amendment, line 3, insert licensee and delete person. Line 4 changes real property to real estate. 16, real property to real estate. Page 39, the use of broker in statute prior to these cleanup changes might have meant responsible broker or simply someone holding a real estate license. The insertion of responsible before broker clarifies. This page is cleanup for consistency of terms used throughout the statutes. Line 5 through 6 conflicted with a narrower area of the statute. All offers need to be presented to both the buyer and the seller. Page 40, clarification. Page 41, lines 1 through 17 are housekeeping for clarification. 23 through line 7 of page 42 increases the fine to $5,000 for performing real estate activity without a license. Page 42, housekeeping cleanup language. 43, lines 1 through 6, allowing for the use of electronic media. 14 through 24, cleanup language. Page 44, 4 through 10, clarifies what is needed to renew a license. Old language allowed the license to remain in effect even if all requirements weren't met. 19 through 21, clarification. 45, cleanup language. In the amendment, line 18 changes real property to real estate. Line 22 to 24, continuing on to page 46, lines 1 and 2, repeal. This is not needed as it is covered by paragraphs A, F, and G of this section. Page 46, lines 1 through 2, ensure that the name of the real estate company is in an ad so that the public understands that the company, so the public understands they are working with the licensee. Balance of this page is cleanup. Page 47, beginning line 17 and to line 2, page 48, clarifies the requirement for advertising property owned by a licensee. The accepted practice is that if you're a licensee, you may have an unfair advantage over the public. Therefore, the licensee should disclose to the public they are licensed, even if they own the property they are advertising. In the amendment, line 5 changes real property to real estate. Line 6 strikes whether, inserts unless, strike or not. Line 12 changes real property to real estate and further amends the line to mirror line 6. Line 14, after associated, insert, strike the balance of the line, and line 15. The purpose of this section of the amendment allows a licensee to advertise his own property for sale or lease without including the name of his company. Many licensees own rental property and with broker's permission do not run these properties through the real estate company. However, they still must disclose they are a licensee. Lines 18 and 20 change real property to real estate. Page 48, lines 1 and 2 allow the use of a nickname on advertising if that name is reflected on the license. The balance of the page is cleanup. In the amendment, line 7, strike licensed. Page 49, lines 9 through 11, insert language allowing for brokers to use a title company in lieu of having a trust account. The remainder of this page is conforming language. In the amendment, line 19 adds S to the word funds and deletes S from the word holders. Page 50, housekeeping and clarity. Page 51, conforming and clarity. 52, conformity and cleanup. Page 53, lines 7 through 13, is a substantive change, although not different from accepted best practices. It clarifies what records a responsible broker must retain. The bottom line is that all documents reduced to writing, regardless of whether the deal closed or not, shall be retained for 7 years. The balance is housekeeping. 54, clean up and clarity. 55, line 6, increases the amount to $10,000. The balance is conforming or cleanup language. 56, lines 17 through 18 clarify that the commission still has the right to investigate and discipline, if necessary, the user of the fund. 57, cleanup language. 58, cleanup language. 59, lines 1 through 14. The bill corrects a conflict in the statute that deals with designated licensee that was passed 2 years ago. In one section, it was clear that in a two-person office, you could utilize designated licensee if one licensee was a responsible broker and the other was an associate broker. But in this section, it requires a responsible broker to immediately appoint a transaction broker if he was representing the other party. That was not the original intent, so the bill clarifies that if both parties are represented by a licensee, that is, a responsible broker or associate broker, there is no need for a transaction manager. The balance of the page is conforming language. 60, conforming language, cleanup. 61, cleanup and conforming in the amendment, line 18, changes real property to real estate. Page 62, line 14, is cleanup language from the passage of the agency legislation 2 years ago. The buyer's intent to occupy the home is not a material fact that an intermediary should disclose. The balance of the page in cleanup is cleanup and conforming language. Amendment, line 23, changes real property to real estate. Page 63, conforming cleanup. These are the repealers. If you have any questions about any of them, please ask. Amendment, line 9, adds 33, 28. 119 little b to the repealer is noted on page 45 and 46 of the bill, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We are on the amendment. Let's see. Senator Escobel.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if my good senator from eastern Laramie County could go over that again, please.
Roll call on that.
Okay, on the amendment. Any question on the amendment? Seeing none, the question on Senator Cooper's motion that Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 119 do pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. We are back on the bill. Any question on the bill? Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, folks, I have serious reservations about a 63-page bill coming through the floor that hasn't gone through an interim study. Now, while this appears that there is mostly supposedly cleanup language, I'm not sure about that. For instance, on page 42, we take the figure from $1,000 to $5,000, but I have no idea why. On page 55, we go from $4,000 to $10,000. I have no idea why. We have a two-page amendment out of the Standing Committee as a Standing Committee amendment. I applaud the Minerals Committee for all their hard work, but I seriously question whether or not we can take on good faith, and I'm not questioning anybody here, but to take this as it is, and hope that we know what we're doing when you pass a 63-page bill that hasn't been through an interim committee. So I'd urge you to cautious consideration of this.
Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think some caution is always appropriate, whether it's been through an interim committee or not. And I've recalled a number of bills over the years that have been a lot longer than this that didn't go through an interim committee that we passed and worked perfectly well. I don't think that going through an interim committee should be a requirement for one of these things. But, Mr. Chairman, this is basically a licensure bill, and I was on the last one, let's look where the fencing is. And I see on page 41, the fencing, says any individual performing real estate activity without first obtaining license guilty of a misdemeanor. Okay, let's look at the definition then of real estate activity to see what you have to be licensed to do. And that's found on page 12. And it's found on page 13, and it's a number of things you'd expect, but negotiate on lines 13 and 14, rental or leasing of real estate. Page 13, lines 21 and 22, collects, offers, or attempts or agrees to collect rent for the use of real estate. And I haven't found an exemption section. I expect it's in the existing statute and not in the bill, but maybe I've just missed it because of the length of the bill. And my question is, there are a lot of people that manage rental properties. You hire a property manager for it. And one of the duties of that property manager is frequently to collect the rent. Do they have to be licensed under this act to do that? There are people around who manage agricultural properties. And frequently with an agricultural property, you wind up on one side or another either renting some real estate to run the cows on temporarily or leasing some real estate to the neighbor to run the cows on temporarily. There's a fair amount of that that's incidental to the business of running a farm or ranch. Are we prohibiting those things? My question is, really, who are we fencing out of what with this bill? And I'd like some assurance on those points. Otherwise, I would think maybe it ought to be set aside and sent through an interim committee.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The language on pages 13 and 14 are existing language, and they were just moved over into this area and alphabetized for their current law.
Senator Cooper.
Mr. Chairman, to go to the question of how the bill was put together and how what happened, well, I just want to indicate to you the testimony that we heard in committee was that actually the state folks, real estate state folks, and also the real estate brokers themselves and their organization had actually gotten together for many meetings. Now, whether many meetings is 3 months, 3 weeks, 3 days, we weren't sure on that, but nevertheless, they had many meetings to get together and to work over this bill and to put it together before it came up to our committee. Now, I understand the concern about such a large bill coming to a committee without going through interim. And I will tell you that the committee also voiced that concern to the bringers of this bill. But we decided to go ahead and work through it because it appeared that many of the changes they were making was just a matter of getting the language up to speed with what general practice was anyway. And there were so many parts of the bill that, or parts of the existing statutes that really needed to be reformed. And but I will tell you that they it was indicated that there was fair extensive amount of work done on this by these folks. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, well, I'm sure that the real estate folks are happy with it, and it does what they want. My question relates to, are they fencing out somebody else? And particularly where the somebody else is not an organized profession, I think we have to watch out for that down here. We're the ones that have to put a stop to that. Mr. Chairman, is there an exemption section? If so, where is it and what is it covered? And specifically, does somebody who's managing farm and ranch property now need a real estate license? Does somebody who is managing a rental property, hired as a building manager or property manager, do they need a real estate license? I'm uncomfortable with this bill absent the answer to those questions.
Senator Cooper?
Mr. Chairman, my earlier statement went to the question that was brought from the good senator here next to me from Laramie County and not directed to the good senator from Natrona County.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good questions. And I never heard one time in any of the testimony as we worked the bill, and we did put a lot of time into this bill, of anything that would change adding to the fencing or whatever that is already not in our present statutes. We will double-check that. I'm almost 90% sure, 99% sure that doesn't. If this bill should move forward, we will bring back all the statutes, show you all the cross-references, and let you know that there has been no changes relative to those particular things. The other thing I would share with the members of the Senate is that when we looked at this bill, and because of the complexity and the majority floor leader's comments, we wanted to spend the appropriate amount of time to really get into it rather than just taking carte blanche what the Real Estate Commission wanted to do and what they wanted to say and the members of the commission, but also the profession themselves. And we went through this bill extensively. In fact, we had a working group with my senator, my colleagues from the western part of the state and from Albany County that spent a considerable amount of time going through it to ensure that, in fact, had been done properly. So we'll come back with answers to that. And we'll try to get you more answers and we'll be more specific if that'll help.
Senator Ross.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I've received any answers to my question. I mean, why are we taking on a first offense the fine from $1,000 to $5,000 and imprisonment not to exceed 6 months? Well, that's generally, I mean, we have high misdemeanors that go 6 months to up to $1,000, and now it's $5,000. And then you go on for $5,000 and 1 year. I believe this would be a subsequent violation. No justification whatsoever that I've heard yet as to why you would have the same fine for a first offense as you do for a second offense. These are substantive changes. I have had no explanation with regard to the $10,000 with regard to the judgment. That may be appropriate, but I haven't heard anything.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm pretty sure I know those answers, but I'm not going to bet the bottom dollar on it. So I will get both of those answers and give them on the floor.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, the question is on Senator Cooper's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with a do-pass motion on Senate File 119. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Chair is in doubt. Division. All those in favor stand. Loud noes. Loud noes. Loud noes.
21.
Senate File 119 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 106. Will the reading clerk please read the file?
Senate File 106, School Finance Local Resources, an act relating to school finances, sponsored by the School Finance Committee. He was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson. No, Senator Von Fladen, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises and report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of due pass for Senate File Number 106. There is a Standing Committee Amendment, and I'd ask to be read in.
Senate File 106, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 106. And I'll explain the amendment with the bill and then call for the question, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, this is an interim bill that was advanced forward by the Select Committee on School Finance. It's an important bill. It deals with our funding system for schools. And I'll represent you to in advance, if you are a district that borrows money, this is important to you. If you're a district that it's traditionally been a recapture district where your district's been able to hold on to funds for some time, this is a bill that will affect your district. If you're from one of those communities where banks traditionally held on to those funds on time deposits, your banks are going to be interested in this bill as well. So that's sort of the constituency that are going to be affected by this. When you look at the goldenrod that we'll be looking at in the future, that is, the goldenrod is a budget looking at and assumes that all the revenue comes in at one time and all the expenses go out at one time. So as you begin to look at what the goldenrod, it does not tell you at what rate the state spends its money, sends it out the door, and at what times the revenues come in. And if you realize that most of the revenues that come in to finance our schools are property taxes, you know that most of those revenues come in between December and April. But our expenses do not go out at the same time. And so what this bill does is address the matchup between expenses and revenues and how do we pay our bills on a day-to-day basis. One of the last vestiges of the remnants of the old finance system, where counties used to finance their own, the school districts financed their own way, was that it used to be that all the counties in the beginning would send out their taxes, whatever taxes they would collect, that's what they could operate their schools on. Before Campbell 1 began, then we had a system of finance where there was recaptured, there was a formula for captured or the recapture districts to send money back in, and there was even a rebated recapture and a whole series of interesting finances that we tried to equalize funding. Since Campbell 1, the state has paid all the bills. But since Campbell 1, we've held on to part of the vestiges, the remnants of the old system, so that we've allowed counties to hold the money. So counties that have a lot of income keep that revenue. And then we don't ask for them to rebate the difference between what we pay them until the end of the year. If you're a district that doesn't collect enough money, then we start sending money out to you. And in some instances, you may be a recapture district, but you don't get the money at the right time, so we allow you as an entitlement as a district to go out and borrow the money. And we also had a system that we designed in the beginning to allow that we say we'll give you your money up front. We'll give you your third of your money at the beginning, a third in the middle, and a third at the end, without recognition as to when they needed the money. The effect of that is the state's done a lot of borrowing, a tremendous amount of borrowing, and what we're going to go through is to show you how much borrowing we've been doing and the cost effect of it.
But the effect of the present system is that next year the state's going to lose or pay about $12.5 million of interest in order to sustain the present finance system. And what the committee realized is that we simply don't have to do that. We can bring all the revenues into the state and have force the state to pay all the expenses, and we can do that and manage our cash flows in a way that we don't have to borrow money. As we sit today, the state borrows about $378 million in 2010 to pay its bills, even though the revenue is there. The revenue happens to sit in most instances in banks and districts that are the recapture districts, and they're sitting on the cash. Meanwhile, we're going out and borrowing it. Where do we borrow it from? There was a time that the state would go out and borrow it on the bond market through tax anticipation revenue bonds. Then we'd pay it back later. Presently, under the present management with the Treasurer's Office, they are borrowing it from the Common School Permanent Land Fund. The impact of that is that $378 million that would be ordinarily invested long-term is now held in cash reserves, cash so that we can borrow it from it so it's not generating money. As a practical matter, that's frankly a school a year. So if you're a district out there that's looking to build a school, this is a school a year that is being not simply wasted, but essentially being lost in revenues to a variety of sources. Some districts are still losers under the current system, and they're going to the bank, and they're borrowing money during the year to meet their cash flows because their entitlement payments or their recapture payments do not come in early enough, and so they have to go out and borrow money to meet their monthly bills. They're paying that interest out of their foundation guarantee. So those students in those communities are getting they have less to spend for education because they're paying money on debt. Now, there's a constitutional issue, and that is it proper to allow districts that have large amounts of revenue, local revenue, those would be your recapture districts, to sit on large cash money and invest that, then they get more income and their students then get a benefit that the non-recapture districts do. And we think that if we don't fix this, that eventually it'll be a constitutional challenge to set aside the system. So what have we done? The handout to explain this is the multicolored handout. And when you look at it, what you're going to be seeing as you go through are a series of cash flows that you'll be tested on tomorrow. See if you can remember. The front page of it is the front page I'm seeing there is the new fiscal note. And the fiscal note, if you look in the second page, you'll see the $12.5 million loss of income if we don't undertake the finance system. If you look at the page behind it, you see a summary. And the summary is should look like this, and it's a summary that has colored pages, so you'll see the first one is yellow, and you flip, and it's green, and then you see pink, then you see blue. Those pages correspond to the spreadsheets. So if you look at the yellow comment, that corresponds to the yellow spreadsheet. If you look at the green comment, that's relates to the green spreadsheet, pink to pink, blue to blue, etc. What the amendment does, and I'll tell you just to start off with, if you turn to the blue spreadsheet is a good place to start. The blue spreadsheet on the top shows the amendment, and it shows that all districts will be paid 5% of their entitlement guarantee on 5% on July 1, 5% on August, then 9%, 9%, and on through the year. So every district will get those same percentages. Those percentages were determined by an analysis of what each district needs to have to operate. What the interim committee had done is, as I actually said, we're going to base that payment to you based upon your last year's actual utilization. What the Senate Appropriations Committee, the testimony we heard, is that that requires a report to begin with. You have to report what you made last year. And it also assumes then that this year's income is going to be, or your expenses this year will be exactly the same as last year. The testimony is we could eliminate the reporting system. We could make it more equitable if we simply put in these set percentages that everybody gets at the same time. And we believe that we eliminated most of the criticism of the interim work by creating these fixed percentages. No monthly reporting, everybody gets the fixed percentages. That is the principal difference between what the interim committee did and the standing committee did. And then the second part of the standing committee amendment is to provide for monthly accounting by the county treasurers and back so that there's a better accounting system between accounting that takes place between the state and the counties. Mr. Chairman, I ask for questions on the standing committee amendment, and if there are none, then call for the question on that.
Any questions on the standing committee amendment? Seeing none, the question is on Senator Nicholas's amendment that the standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 106 do pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. We're back on the bill. Senator
Thank
Nicholas.
You, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the blue, as I was telling you, it gives you an idea of what was taking place before and after. You can look at on the blue sheet, and you can see the actual today where the entitlement districts received one-third in August, one-third in October, and one-third in February. Then you can see the recapture districts down below where you have we're having to loan them one-third of the guarantee. Then there would be a recapture amount, so the loans would get paid back through the years. When you look at this, when you look at the highlighted boxes on the blues, those generally give you the districts that either have to borrow or either, actually in this case, it's a summary of the difference between the entitlement districts and the recapture districts. Before we, right there, I think I'll jump to the white sheet that you have, which is the final summary of the cash flows. And this gives you an indication of what it looks like from the state of Wyoming's perspective. The proposed distribution Senate File 106 is on the top. And you can see by collecting all the revenues and then paying out bills on a monthly basis, instead of giving some people one-third, loaning to some districts that don't have money, the loaning to the recapture districts, we anticipate that even this year we will have a revenue shortfall in October of $20 million, and that revenue shortfall will be repaid to the Common School Permanent Land Fund in December of 2009. So we've got about a $20 million borrowing. If we do nothing, and you look down at the middle graph, that it says actual, that's based upon fiscal year 10. To meet all of our obligations that we currently finance or under the current finance system, the state of Wyoming has to borrow in October $212 million from the school foundation program account, from the Common School Permanent Land Fund. We can make some payments back in December and some back in January. Then we have to reborrow another $116 million in February. So in total, you've got $378 million worth of borrowing, interfund borrowing. When you see the cost, interest cost of $4.4 million on the right in that, that amount goes up to $12.6 million next year. And incidentally, it does not account for the loss, and that's the interest you pay based upon the interfund borrowing interest. It does not reflect the cost of the lost opportunity to invest that money long-term in the Common School Permanent Land Fund. When you have liquid dollars, when you treat them as our pooled dollars that you have to have available, the pooled funds are gaining around, on average, about 5% interest, whereas the Permanent Land Fund dollars, or long-term investments, are closer to 18%. So there's a three-point spread that's not even reflected on it, and ultimately that's lost revenue to that's paid from the Common School Permanent Land Fund into the school account, which funds our schools in part. The differences are down below. Now that explains in a nutshell what it is that why this we believe that it's appropriate to bring all the money down to Cheyenne and then loan it then and let the treasurer do the money management for all of this money. Now if you're a district that the districts will still have their cash reserves to invest it in their local banks. Those cash reserves that the districts have are on the yellow sheet. So if you want to kind of get a feel for what amount of cash reserves are generally left and housed at banks in the community, they're reflected on the yellow sheet. So there's still substantial monies that that are there. Districts will now not only get their monthly payment, but they also have advantage of their cash reserves. And if you look at it, you'll see that in most instances, the cash reserves are at least the amount of their monthly bills. One of the things that Standing Committee Amendment did is move the payment back into to the 10th of each month. The districts asked, could we get those monies on the 1st? The difficulty with that is that in order for the districts to get their money, there has to be an accounting run, as we call it, through the WOLF system. The WOLF system is the state financial system. The WOLF system runs about twice a week. It's not an uncomplicated task, but it's one that takes a lot of time. The concern is if we move it, try to make payments in the beginning of the month, we'll have to do a WOLF run. If the first of the month lands on a Saturday or a Sunday or there's a holiday, there simply isn't the resources or it's complicated to run it. So what we've agreed with the districts to do is to make the runs on the 10th. The committee this summer had it running on the 15th of the month, so we've moved it back 5 days. So on the 10th of the month, districts get their funds from the state by electronic transfer, so it's right into their accounts, and in most instances that'll be there in time to pay their mid-month and end-of-month bills, and particularly their salaries and things that represent a large part of their dollars. One of the things that that the districts have mentioned is that, well, you know, some of the districts have a lot of capital construction going on, and they kind of like having all of this recapture money in the districts so that they can pay for their capital construction. In response, as we look into it, the School Facilities Commission now also transfers money. They're now paying bills twice a month, so your contractors can get those monies twice a month. So that seemed to be an appropriate issue there. When you begin to look on the impacts of your respective districts, those are the green sheets. And the pink sheets, the green sheet shows the cash flows county by county without borrowing. So you can go look to see whether you're a county that borrows or whether you're a county that generates surpluses. The shaded box sort of represent the counties which are affected by that. So you're looking at you're looking at either one or two of the ends of the spectrum. You've got Niobrara on the one hand, and you've got Campbell County and Sublette on the other hand. The pink sheets, Mr. Chairman, are sort of the same thing, but shows what happens with the borrowing, who's borrowing money. And in some instances, for example, last year, my recollection is that there are counties that are sort of on recapture, counties on the bubble, finding that they aren't able to borrow from the state, and they're having to go out and borrow from banks. An example of that would be Sweetwater County that had to borrow from the banks because they were on the bubble. While they're a recapture district, they didn't get enough money at the right time of the year. So, in summary, what this bill does is send all the local resources that were historically held and housed by the districts throughout the year. And then the recapture districts were able to retain substantial surpluses clear to the end of the year at a time when the state was borrowing money, brings all the revenues to the state, allows us to manage it, and then allows the districts to, or then we pay the districts monthly as they incur the bills to make sure that they're getting their time, their dollars on time. It's more equal. It saves cost to the state. It's more constitutional. If you're a recapture district, there is it will have impact on banks that were had time deposits of a huge amount of money sitting there. Some of the districts were sending their money to investment managers in the Cheyenne and elsewhere. Those investment managers, if they want to invest those dollars, will now have to go to the treasurer. The treasurer has a couple different programs to allow banks to borrow money from or to hold money from the state. You go through a qualification process, and then on a six-month-by-six-month basis, the treasurer will allow state depositories that are insured to receive funds on open account, although it's more like a loan, but essentially it's an open account loan basis, so the banks can have that cash locally. This bill, as a practical moment, does allow the treasurer to allocate some of the funding available that's in surplus for that same program. But as a practical matter, if you look at the cash flow, you will see that the treasurer needs all of the cash at certain times of the month so that the real cash available for the treasurer through that it's in the school foundation program is probably only going to be 3 to 4 months, 6 months at the longest, so that if there is, if the treasurer elects to expand the amount of dollars that are held locally in banks, they'll probably do that through our pooled funds, which is outside this program account. Stand for questions.
Questions? Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question, actually, for my fellow colleague from Albany. If we're establishing payment rates of 5% each for July and August, and then 9% September through June, and yet when you do the calculation based on this installment plan, we still have a discrepancy in October. Why wouldn't we simply overpay October at 10% and then underpay, I believe it would be December, at 8% to kind of compensate for that imbalance and therefore not have the $200,000 in interest expense? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, to respond to that, I think the imbalance is on our side, so that you would have to flip it. You'd have to go 8% to the districts, and then they would get 10% later. So the $20 million is the borrowing level, and I understand what you're saying, but as a practical matter, the shortfall in that money that month is $20 million in order to have the balance of $11 million that's represented there. So it's just a flip. I know it looks like it's, you would think that the first one is the red, but the 20 in red is the payback, the black is the borrowing.
Any other discussion? Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you take the last sheet, the white sheet, and I'm trying to track this, and two questions that come to mind is, did you credit in some way, shape, or form the surpluses in terms of that interest, and maybe that's hard to quantify, because there are huge surpluses that exist at different times. And then on the borrowing side, you know, like in October, we borrowed $212 million, but we really didn't need it to kick in until December, and then only part of it. And then more part of it in January, the same thing with a 166 borrow, yet we don't need it until March and we don't need it till May. And I'm wondering why we're borrowing it if we don't need it, and then what kind of credits do you see for those surpluses that exist at different times in the year?
Senator Nicholas.
I want to make sure that I've explained this well, because if you look on, let's start with the top spreadsheet. The total expenditures on a given month, let's start with July, are $70 million. So you can go through the blue sheet and see what the actual cash expenditures are for the district. It happens to be that at that time we're sitting on about $293 million, so we can cash flow that. Now you go to the actual October, the education expenditures have accumulated. These are there on that day are $205 million. but we only have $11 million to, or that, let me, that leaves a $11 million ending balance with the $20 million of borrowing. And so when you start looking down to the October for the actual FY10, you have October expenses of $284 million, and but we had to borrow $212 million to do that. So you have to look at a combination of things that's taking place, and that is you're running revenues, and that you have revenues that are picking up and stacking up, and then they go all out months, and you have new revenues coming in. So these are the net dollars. And so what I can tell you as maybe another way to explain it is that, remember, there are dollars coming in every month. Most of them come at different times. There are dollars going out, and there are expenditures going out. Your expenditures are generally constant. Your revenues are not coming in at the same time. Your federal mineral royalties are coming in quarterly. Your property taxes are coming in principally December through the end. There are some other revenues. But if you look at October of actual, in order to have a balance of the $3.4 million in the account on that day required a $212 million borrowing to net out. And if I didn't explain that, I'll go behind the account or the curtain here and make sure that our staff is, as soon as they roll, come on, get over here, staff. Make sure that we get it right. Go ahead. I think I answered it, but I'm going to make sure as it comes back.
Any further questions? Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got another couple questions to go. One, I understand on the yellow sheet, these are the cash balances that would be essentially available in reserves or other things to invest in local banks. And the question I would have is, did you do any analysis to show what the difference is? I mean, looking at your county, you can go down there at the end, you see your grand totals are invested in banks, but I don't know what that is. That number is now, and so it's hard for me to understand what this does as far as local bank deposits. I don't know if that's 1/3 or 1/4 or 1/2 of what they would normally have. The other question I have is, I guess the other, what we have is obviously some, and I commend the committee for their efforts to try and update and have a better cash flow management, which is certainly appropriate. I guess one of the problems I have is one of the issues that I hear most common out of my district is slow pay by the state. And so one of the questions I would have is what incentive is there for the state to make sure that they pay timely so that it doesn't back up? And then what is the other issue if ultimately you do this on a scheduled basis? What if the expenditures in any given month are a little bit higher so that they're not covered by the 5% or the 9% that's sent out? That's question two. And I guess those are the three questions. One, what effect are the cash balances compared to what they are now? What's the incentive for the state to pay timely, and then how do we make sure that our constituents out there that are providing services and goods to the school districts are paid timely?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our school staff, finance staff are going to be here in a moment, but I think I figured out the answer. Let's go back to the Fremont County issue, which addresses in part the Trona County. When you look at the actual expenses on October for the FY, this is the white sheet, looks like it, October, when you see $230 million of total revenues and transfers, the transfers would include the $212 million borrowings, so that if you look to see what is going to happen on that month without that $212 million, you'd take your $230 million, you would reduce that, you would see you quickly cannot pay your expenses that day without the borrowing. Meanwhile, if you go up to the proposed distribution In the revenues and transfers, that $65 million, that would include the transfer of the $20 million, which is the borrowing amount. And you can see by managing our, all of our revenues that we reduce, that we can meet our bills and have an ending balance of $11 million. Had we not borrowed the $20 million, it would have been a deficit on that day. So the Treasurer simply did a rounding number, enough to come up with $20 million to make sure there was $11 million in the School Foundation Program account that day. Now, with respect to the locals, when you look at the blue sheet and you begin to look at the numbers that we've signed, the 5%, 5%, 9%, those sorts of things, you can see that on a month-by-month, on a district-by-district basis, we are distributing sufficient funds to pay all of their operations on that month. And, you know, folks, the way I see this is that if it turns out that we've made an error, all the districts are going to see it together at the same time because they're all getting the same percentages. And we'll all come down to solve it. But based upon the cash flows, these percentages will meet those bills. Now, what will end up happening is that you do have some heavy months and overnight months, and you will, as the 5%, 5% goes through the years, the districts do tend to accumulate more towards the tail end of the year. That's just a natural phenomenon of all government budgeting. With respect to the cash, the argument that the state is slow, these funds are required to be wire transferred, and they are electronically fund sent on the 10th of the day, the 10th of the month. I believe that when you talk about the issue of slow pay, it's not an issue with respect to their foundation guarantee amounts on the day they're entitled to. They may have been criticism with respect to capital construction items that are they're paid for by the School Facilities Commission, which is a different area. And we have addressed that to require the Facilities Commission to pay twice a month. And that's an issue with respect, it's always an issue, and that is that the contractors are sending their bills to the district because the district entered the contract. The district then sends the bills they're required to approve or disapprove, then they send it to the Facilities Commission, they look at it, and then a payment is made, and we do need to make sure that those times are tight. But the flip side of it is that's a simple contracting issue with respect to your construction contracts. You just say, you'll get payment as soon as we get from the School Facilities Commission.
I said that right.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To pick up with my good senator friend from Natrona County, I had the same need for information, which is, you know, we're taking what looks to be out of at least 10 or 12 communities some significant ability to, you know, to invest in local banks, local institutions, and we're gonna take that money back to Cheyenne. And I guess I'd like to hear a little bit more conversation about what was talked about in the interim with regard to investing in Wyoming. Those are institutions that take very good care of our communities, that's a pretty significant amount of resource we're going to be pulling out of there and bringing to Cheyenne, which may or may not invest in in-state institutions. I think I heard the good chairman say that that there were programs available. I guess I'd just like to hear a little bit more about where that money is going to be housed and what impact it's going to have on some of those communities out there.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a follow-up to my earlier questions. One of them is, so we go down here and going to, on the white sheet, if we just pick a month, and let's say that any given month, we just pick one. We'll just pick, let's pick November. Of the actual November, and let's say that in going forward, and we've got so much of that distributed. What happens if a district is, let's just do it by example, and if I'm out of line for just saying, if we go to the top chart, we'll just talk about Albany County since it's the first one, just for an example. So one, what if Albany County is short $100,000 on the expenses? Is there any recourse? for them to go back to the state and say, wait, can we get an extra 0.5% or 1% in this month so that we can go ahead and make sure that our people are paid timely, our vendors and providers are paid timely? So that's one question, is how rigid is there going to be any flexibility when we allocate and budget out these expenses, or do we just have to tell the vendors to wait? So that's question one. The other question would be also looking at Albany County. When I look at the gold sheet, if I understand this, we're talking about a summary of cash balances. We just take the top one again, Albany County. Would say that Albany County, even in this program, would typically have about $6 million to be invested or deposited in local bank accounts. And so my question is, do we have any idea what that number is under the current system? What is Albany's cash reserves now under the current system, so that we can understand what effect that will have on local institutions when we take that money out? So I don't know if that's another $1 million or if that's another $20 million. I don't see that in the worksheets here.
Senator Nicholas, with respect to the, I'll start from the back and go forward. With respect, this is the current under the gold sheet, and moving forward, all districts get to keep 15% of their prior year guarantee moving forward. So there will always be significant cash reserves. With respect to the schedule that we built on the White schedule. There should be, and there we expect that there will never be the instances that's described, because the payments are in advance of the expenditures. And we've set the payments at a high enough percentage level to make sure they're always in advance. So not only your payments advance of the schedule, but you also have your carryover 15% reserves. And I get the nod that I said that correctly. That's always good. Now, with respect to let's go back to the local banking issue, and it's an issue. If you believe that the taxpayers throughout the state of Wyoming paid the money to support the schools, and what they really intended to do is put the money in the banks, fair enough. But the reality of it is that while there was a time where counties were funded, schools were funded at county level, these tax dollars are now paid throughout the state to support the schools of the state. The dollar's primary purpose is not to fund banks. And I understand that we want all of our banks to have resources, but there are a couple counties out there that their banks had on-time deposits. In some instances, by the way, the banks, if those counties had lots of money, they might not have sat them on time deposits. They may have sent them back to investment managers as well. When the dollars come into the treasurer has a variety of programs to invest. We spend, on the order of my last recollection, is $14 to $20 million a year to money managers to invest all the monies in both. We invest the pooled monies, the permanent mineral trust funds. We pay about another $14 million of investment bankers and advisors for the retirement accounts. I want to say there's probably $28 million a year going out to people to manage all of our money. And as part of that program, the treasurer allocates money to hold back, make sure that it's available for banks in the state of Wyoming. Right now, the testimony is there's more held back than there is demand for the money, partly because the federal government rate is so low. People aren't looking to bring the state money in. But no matter how you look at it, we are losing about $12.5 million of interest payment that we're having to pay. We're losing money on the top of that from the lost investment of having about $300 million liquid instead of long-term investment. That's about a school a year. If you believe that that's it's more important to have that money just sitting in banks so that they can make money. Meanwhile, while one district, by the way, is sitting on cash, a lot of it, the other one's out borrowing and using its foundation guarantee monies to pay for that. And there are those of us, and there's a good argument, that system is unconstitutional. While there are two or three districts that get to augment the dollars that are available for student learning and student teaching for sports activities, that's not available to the other districts, particularly those that have to borrow.
Senator Perkins.
I'm
just about done with my questions, and the chairman's doing a great job and commending for his answers and staff. The other two questions, when we talked about you get the 15% of the prior year to have as the reserve, and I'm just wondering, is that reserve cumulative, or is it always just pegged at 15% of the reserve? And then the second question is there anything that you're aware of in the statute that would prevent the loaning from the cash balances here if there were shortfalls or other issues, or anything that would prevent the loaning of these cash balances to cover expenses until the payments from the state came in?
With respect to the 15%, Mr. Chairman, with respect to the 15%,
that's fixed on your prior year, and so it's recalculated every year. With respect to the loaning, I apologize, but I'm not quite understanding. I mean, these are their cash reserves. These are the dollars that sit there to make sure that they can pay their bills. It's like when you look at the Golden Ride, you're going to see that we have a statutory reserve of 5%, and you hold that just to make sure that at any given time your checks balance. And obviously there are things that are unforeseen. There are major maintenance amounts that are calculated out there. There are a lot of areas, but we've generally agreed that being able to carry over that 15% provides a sufficient cash flow for the school districts to run their bank accounts. Did that answer your question?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, question in entirely different mode, because, you know, we've been talking about this, having enough working capital and some of the cash flows and whatnot. What I'm wondering is on the incentives in the system. Suppose the school district discovers a more economical way to do something and can save some money. Over the years, I've seen a number of government programs. What they do is they make sure that they spend everything so that they aren't dinged in the future. Nature of how people manage a government program. And at the end of the fiscal year, you sometimes see quite a bit of expenditure that is somewhat questionable. My question is, in this, do we have the incentives such that if a district finds a way to do something that's more economical, is the incentive for them to take that saved money and spend it by the end of the year so they don't get cut back in the future? Can they carry it over and use it in the next year for something else?
Mr. Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the present system, all you're entitled to carry over is 15%. So if a district found a creative way to carry over more than 15%, it would actually count as a local resource and then reduce your entitlement going forward. So I think the answer to that is if you believe the districts ought to have an opportunity to save those dollars and carry them forward, it wouldn't be this bill that we would take a look at. Rather, we'd be take a look at what is that 15% carryover, and if you can reduce your dollars so that your carryover was 30%, should you say, well, district, if you can do that, we'll allow you to keep as a local, or not count as an additional amount as a local resource. But that's the 15% is what governs that, and that's the trigger. It applies to everybody. So I suppose if a district really believed that they could, if you believe that a district could somehow save more than 15% of its total annual budget, then there is no incentive. We'd have to change that 15% rule and what gets counted as a local resource.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, following up on that, you know, we're spending an awful lot of money on schools in this state. We're not getting results commensurate with the amount we're spending. And I think maybe one of the things we need to look at, and it's clearly probably only a small piece of it, is it seems to me we've built an incentive into the system for making sure, particularly toward the end of the year, that there's some wasteful spending so that you don't get it counted as a local resource and get dinged on it in the future. And I suspect this is not necessarily the bill to do that in, but I think we need to think about what we're doing because I think we've built a perverse incentive into the system.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I need to clear up on the white sheet that you handed out, that the proposed distribution and the actual on the expenses. I'm not following the reason why there's such a huge difference on the actual monthly expenses. As I read them, they go from about $8 million to $320 million. And then if you go to the proposed, the expenses are different again. Can you explain to me where I can follow that, why the expenses are like they are?
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I can, and I'll try to summarize it and then tell you that the white sheet essentially is a compilation of all of the three sheets, in a sense, all the spreadsheets. So when you're looking at the actual today, you're having to combine recapture districts, entitlement districts, and together so that we have, with respect to the entitlement districts, you have the one-third loans. With respect to the guaranteed, or actually, I think I flipped that around, but there's a we pay out monies to entitlement districts as loans, and then we have guarantees to other districts. So that if you began to look at, well, I guess another way to say it is that on the existing system, the state's total expense is $9 million, and as it actually exists, that's because a lot of districts, well, actually, we were paying our monies mostly in October, so we've changed that. I mean, you got to remember that our first payments were used to go out in advance and later in the year. What we're doing now is instead of waiting and giving people large blocks of money that we used to do, we're now going to give you money every month so that we're managing the revenues on a monthly basis and the so that when you begin to look at the actual, there are probably three or four things interacting. One is that the biggest payments were not coming until, I want to say, September, or actually they were August. So you had August payments. Then you had low guarantees in August, and we weren't paying back in July. We've started the payments 1 month earlier than we used to be. Then you have some districts that were receiving money because they were entitlement districts. And then we had some districts that were the recapture districts where they were getting loans to pay their bills in advance. So if you look over on the blue sheet, you can begin to look at the entitlement districts when they received their one-thirds of the money. They were not picking them up monthly. You look at the recapture districts down below, they were getting loans in August, January, and March. And then you have the months that they were repaying. So you can't pinpoint it to one event. It is a combination of about four things that are happening. Entitlement districts are holding their money, entitlement districts are don't get paid. They were getting a lump sum early, and they weren't getting it monthly. The recapture districts haven't borrowed their money yet. There is, and we weren't paying the bills on a monthly basis, and we switched that. Does that explain it?
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I believe so. But then on this chart, the expenses are the foundation program expenses, not actual totals of the district expenses.
These are the actual cash flows going out, not the actual district expenses. If you want to see the district expenses, you go to the other spreadsheets to make, and those would allow you to look at the actual expenses versus the actual payments.
Any further discussion? Seeing none. The question is on Senator Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 106 as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 106 has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority, Floor Leader, Senator Ross. Where you go?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ross.
I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
Motion passed. It'll get better as time went on.
Here we go.
Hey, now you work. I'm glad to have you.
Reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 85, do pass. Senate File 91, do pass amended. Senate File 93, do pass amended. Senate File 117, do pass amended. Senate File 119, do pass amended. And Senate File 106, do pass amended. Senator Meyer, Chairman.
I'm going to go up and mute.
Senator Meyer.
Mr.
President. You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. That motion is carried. The report has been adopted. Messages from the House.
January the 31st, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 178, third reading, pass amended. Mr. President, the bill listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill 127, School Finance Recalibration, ayes 57, noes 7, Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
January the 31st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Mineral Business and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 121, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, and Jennings. No, Senator Rossbuth, Senator Bebout, Chairman. January the 21st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 98, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Meyer, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott. No, Senator Dockstader, Senator Scott, Chairman. Aye, Senators Martin, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott. No, Senator Dockstader, Senator Scott, Chairman. January the 31st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 109, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, Jennings, and Rothstuff, Senator Bebout, Chairman. January the 31st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Mineral Business and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 111, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, Jennings, and Rothfuss, Senator Bebout, Chairman. January the 31st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 113, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, Jennings, and Rothfuss, Senator Bebout, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk. Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I would ask that Senate File 121, which contains an appropriation, be re-referred to the Appropriations Committee, number 2.
Thank you, Senator Bebout. The request is that Senate File 121 be re-referred to Committee number 2. Seeing no, hearing no objection, that would be so ordered. Any other requests? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that then clears the desk.
Mr. President, members of the Senate, just as an update, we have five more days for bills on general file, Senate files. Cutoff is a week from today. So, Chairman, if there's if you got issues or whatnot with regards to the general file, let me know. But I will tell you that that we are moving along at a pretty good pace, and actually, I think I know we are way ahead of the House in terms of their ability to get bills through general file. We've gone at a pretty good pace. It may get a little bit more lengthy in the day as we start considering some of these education bills and other things that need to be heard on general file before Monday. So with that, Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, February 1st.
Any announcements? Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number five, Agriculture, Public Land, and Water Resources, will meet tomorrow night upon adjournment, and we're going to take up House Bill 8, Engrossed Wyoming Traditional Food Act, House Bill 15, Engrossed Weed and Pest Control, House Bill 57, Feral Livestock, and House Bill 18, Engrossed Quarantine Animals.
Senator Meyer.
President. Your committee number two, Appropriations, will meet upon adjournment in about 10 minutes up in S-13. We'll begin work on Senate File 135, University of Wyoming Federal Mineral Royalties, Senate File 144, State-Funded Construction Projects and Preference Provisions. Mr. President, we will then break if we don't, when the House breaks, and we will meet as a JAC. And go over the budget and make some final votes on that. And then tomorrow, Mr. President, we will meet on Tuesday in, at 8 a.m. in S-13 to consider Senate File 70, Educational Accountability, Senate File 104, Meningococcal Vaccination, and Senate File 118, Career and Technical Training Grants, and Senate File 131, Military Department federally funded positions.
Senator Beba.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number nine, Minerals, will meet Wednesday, February 2nd, 15 minutes after the noon recess in room S-18 to continue discussion on Senate File 105, State Control of Certain Land, House Bill 108, Engrossed Collection Agencies, and House Bill 112, Engrossed Mining Permits.
Senator Perkins.
President, your committee number one, Judiciary, will meet Wednesday, February the 2nd at 8 a.m. in room S-1 to consider the following bills. House Bill 105, Temporary Military Duty, Child Custody and Visitation. House Bill 68, Violent Felony Definition Expansion. House Bill 19, Assignment of Retired Circuit Court Judges.
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, Wyoming Lodging and Restaurant Association have asked me to remind you of their reception tonight at Little America. They are the sponsor, along with the Travel Industry Association, the Retail Association, and the Automobile Dealers. These are the people who put these things on professionally, so it should be a good time.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, your committee number eight, Transportation, will meet in about 10 minutes or 11 minutes up in S-14. We will take up Senate File 152, Tolling Authority for I-80, House Bill 33, Engrossed, Exceeding Speed Limit while passing, and House Bill 41, Engrossed, Driving Within a Single Lane.
Any other announcements? Senator Escobel.
Mr. President, Representative Mary Throne has asked me to announce that she is presently taking orders for the 61st legislative mugs. They should arrive in a couple of days, and she would prefer for you to place your order via email. You don't have to pay for them until they arrive, and they're $5 a piece.
You want to get mugged? Then you can talk to Representative Throne. Any other announcements come before the body this afternoon? Seeing none, you have heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion is carried. We stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, February 1st. Senate is adjourned.